just want a reaction.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining us for another episode of A Journey Through Stock, Aitken Waterman. I'm Gavin Scott from chartbeats.com.au, and my co-host is Matthew Denby. Hi, Matt.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be back. Thanks for all the great feedback on the last episode where we said goodbye to Saw's first major act. This episode, we've got another big landmark with a double serving of Saw's brand new international superstar, as well as a couple of other big fan favourites.
One of the recurring themes of this podcast has been that record companies basically suck. From artists stuck in their contracts that they can't get out of, to others that just didn't receive support from their labels, we've heard it all. When the going gets tough, record companies are the first one out the door. But when there's a glimmer of some money to be made, well, then it's a different story. That was the case with our first single this episode. Here is Learning to Live Without Your Love by OG Brown and Rick Astley.
All I can do is carry on living with you.
I'm learning to live without your love. Now that you're gone.
OG Brown and Rick Astley there on Learning to Live Without Your Love. Now, by late 1987, which is when that single came out, OG Brown had moved on to her next album with Magnet Records called Light the Night. She'd released a couple of singles from it when some bright spark realised that languishing away on her previous album, Ochi, the one that Stock Aitken Waterman worked on, was a duet with a singer who just happened to have the biggest single of the year. So Magnet were hoping to capitalise on the success of Never Gonna Give You Up, and they lifted Learning to Live Without Your Love from Ochi, thinking that Rick's name alone would sell it. But there was no video, no promotion, just a song. And it's a good song. Matt, what did you think of this song?
Yeah, look, it's a nice little song, but to me it's an album track and it should have stayed on the album. This is really a gratuitous record company cash-in. It's not an obvious hit. It sounds pleasant enough to me, but I don't think even Rick was really used to his full effect here. I don't think that, the Rick Astley that came alive on Never Gonna Give You Up had quite realised his full potential when this record was produced. He's a bit flat. He's a bit sort of monotonous in parts even. You know, interesting little curio from the past, but it didn't deserve to chart, and it was a bit of a dog act by Magnet to try and cash in and perhaps, you know, derail what was going to come next for Rick.
I mean, obviously they would put it out. If I had this track sitting there and suddenly Rick Astley had the biggest single in not only the UK but the world, I would put it out too. So I can understand exactly what Magnet were doing. Like you, I don't think it's the world's best song. I like it though. It's a nice little ballad. It was a nice change of pace for Ochi, because let's not forget, this was really Ochi's single that Rick was guesting on, compared to her version of Whenever You Need Somebody and 100% Pure Pain and her previous single, Two Hearts Beating as One. It was a nice little change of pace. It showed that she had a bit of versatility. But yeah, I agree. I don't think it was going to be a massive hit. It was just, you know, record companies being record companies. Shall we hear what Ochi had to say about this track?
Let's do.
I have never met Rick Astley. I've never met him. I've never heard him mention me or read anything that he's mentioned me. I was just presented with this album and this guy, Rick Astley, was on it. Him and I singing a duet, but that was all technology that we've never, ever met. I'd love to meet him, but we never have. I was told about him. Peter told me that he'd met this young man. He had a great voice, da-da-da. He wanted us to sing together. And then I got the album and Rick was on it, which is great. It's a lovely thing. But people always ask me about him. I've never met him. I don't know.
This was recorded very much with the two of you doing your part separately.
Yes, totally separate. And I think that Rick was new to PWL. So Peter Waterman had a lot of faith in me. You know, he was saying to me, you're going to do well, you're going to do this. And so Rick was put on the album as a maybe introduction.
And so what did you think of the duet? Did you like that song, Learning to Live?
I don't know. I don't know what to say. I think the vocals are really low on it, deep vocals. It's not my favourite. Sorry.
You're allowed not to like things. They're your songs.
Yeah, It's not my favourite.
Well, at least she's honest. Now, Learning to Live Without Your Love didn't chart, as had neither of her previous two singles from her Light the Night album. She'd released covers of Rock Your Baby and also I Got a Feeling. Neither of them did anything. Let's hear a little bit of Rock Your Baby now. So that was Ochi's high energy cover of Rock Your Baby, which I thought was an interesting step for her. She'd obviously been on the soul side of things with PWL as opposed to the high energy side, and here she was doing a big high energy remake of a disco hit. What did you make of that, Matt?
Perhaps it was a natural evolution, because Ochi did tell us earlier in the podcast that when she was doing all her PAs around the UK, she found that she had this really sort of engaged, devoted gay audience, especially with 100% Pure Pain. She really, really got a great reaction in some of the gay clubs. Perhaps they decided that she wasn't breaking through as an R&B act in the UK. Perhaps there was some potential there for a gay audience to sort of push her into the top 40, and maybe they decided to really go for the throat with that one. Unfortunately, it didn't come off. But, you know, we do love Ochi on this podcast, don't we?
We do. And we've got one last snippet of our interview with Ochi where she talks about getting a bit disillusioned with her recording career and her decision to move on. So here is Ochi.
I was really quite disappointed that two tracks, Whenever You Need Somebody and 100% Pure Pain, had the potential to do really well, and they hadn't for me. And it was really quite frustrating. And then I worked with Junior Giscombe, and Steve Rodway was a young producer at the time. And if you listen to the tracks with Junior Giscombe, there's much of the phrasing that sounds like Junior. Not my phrasing, because he had written some of these tracks. So I started to feel a bit like I was getting lost in other people's creativity, if you like. I had my own sound, my own voice. I can sing. You know, there's lots of things I can't do that I should be able to do. Cook. I can actually sing. So it was frustrating for me. And after a while, I just thought the heart of it wasn't there. I wanted to sing. I wanted to be able to sing. I would do live performances all over Europe, in England and stuff like that. I wanted to sing live. I wanted to sing with a band. That's where my best energy was. You know, my best feelings, my best performances were live. And I wasn't really doing that. I was in the studio and being told, sing like this, sing like that. And I think that people sign an artist because they've heard something they've done and they really like it. And then they try to change it, change you completely. And I didn't push against that change, because I was in a position where I was making records, going to the studio, singing. That's what I wanted to do. So I wasn't pushing against it. But I kind of started to feel like my creativity and my energies were being pressed down, if that makes sense. And don't forget, my journey started with me writing, recording, producing, and releasing my own stuff. I set up my own business to do it. And I was happy to work with other people. I'm a musician, of course, you're happy to do that. But then when it feels like you can't breathe in your work, then that's quite difficult, quite hard.
It must be gratifying all these years later that era, as difficult as it maybe was in some respects, still resonates so strongly with fans. And here we are talking about it because people are still love those tracks.
I know, it's amazing. I was in my office one day and the phone rang. I picked the phone up and there's a guy on the end of the phone saying, "Are you Ochi Brown?" And it stopped me in my tracks completely. I went, "Who are you?" And he said, "Oh, we're doing this concert, PWL, and da da da, and would you get involved?" And I was like, "Oh my God, this is like what, 30 years ago? What's going on?" So yeah, it is fantastic. Talking to you about this and reliving all this stuff is wonderful. wonderful. I had generally a good time in the music business. I worked hard, I made money, I met lots of people, I made lots of friends. And now my children are moving down that road and I have some experience that I can support them or help them with. So I'm happy. I'm good.
After the Magnet years kind of ended, did you continue doing other things musically or did you kind of close the door on your music career?
Magnet had decided to sell up to Polygram, I think. And the idea was that I would re-sign my contract and move with Magnet to Polygram. And I didn't want to re-sign. That's the truth of it. I just said enough. I was writing a little bit, performing. I did small gigs around. I like to sing jazz now. When that whole thing ended with Magnet, I didn't even listen to music for a few years, to be honest with you. But then, you know, I met some musicians and we start to get together and we do gigs and I enjoy it. Because for me, music is a business. And a really important business in lots of ways. But when you're creating stuff, it's about how you feel. You know, there may be a time when you're making lots of money and, you know, you're moving around and then that becomes more important. But I never got to that stage. I'm at the stage still where music is my heart, how I feel.
But it sounds like you had to get out of the music business to enjoy music.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Is that an accurate read?
Yeah, well done. That is an accurate read of it. I had to get out of it to enjoy it, definitely.
Thanks for that, Ochi. Now, they may never have met, but Learning to Live isn't the only song that links Ochi Brown and Rick Astley, is it, Matt?
That's right. Well, he'd given Sora a global number one smash with Never Gonna Give You Up, so the stakes were high when Rick Astley returned with the official follow-up and the second single from his debut album. Whenever You Need Somebody by Rick Astley came out in October of 87. Let's have a listen. That was Whenever You Need Somebody by Rick Astley. It proved to be a worthy follow-up to his debut hit, charting very highly across the world. It reached number one in Germany, Sweden and Switzerland, number two in Denmark, Netherlands, Norway and Spain, number three in the UK and Australia and Ireland, number four in Austria, number nine in New Zealand, number 11 in France and 17 in Iceland. Now, of course, long-time listeners of this podcast know full well that this song was a recycle of Ochi Brown's dance favourite. Gavin, what did you think of this version?
At the time, in 1987, I had no idea that anyone else had recorded Whenever You Need Somebody before Rick Astley. So for me, it was his song. And I didn't like it anywhere near as much as Never Gonna Give You Up. And I don't know if that was just kind of my spidey sense tingling that it wasn't written for Rick, because Never Gonna Give You Up was completely crafted for Rick. And as we know, they spent 6 months getting it absolutely right. Whereas this song was something they had in the cupboard, thought, why don't we try this one with Rick, and he recorded it. You know, he did a good vocal. I just didn't feel like it was as natural a fit as Never Gonna Give You Up. But, you know, it charted really well. Obviously, it didn't chart in America because it wasn't released in America, where Ochi had had a number one dance hit with her version. Let's just refresh our memories by hearing the Ochi version quickly. Matt, what did you make of Rick's cover?
I instantly liked it. Like yourself, I had never heard Ochi's version at the time. Now, while I did like it, I did not feel it was as effortlessly perfect and on the money as Never Gonna Give You Up. And I think they definitely nailed that energy much better with the next Made for Rick single, Together Forever, but we'll get to that soon enough. However, I did like Whenever You Need Somebody, and I liked it more than enough to get the album, which came out quite soon after this single. So yeah, it's a winner. It worked all over the world. Shame it wasn't released in the US.
Now, one thing we didn't mention when we discussed Ochi's version of the song was the reference track for Whenever You Need Somebody. And some of you listeners have pointed out that we were remiss in not mentioning that. So here is Dancing in the Key of Life by Steve Arrington, which was a reference for the original Ochi version of Whenever You Need Somebody. Don't you know that you're dancing for-
Right, that's a very familiar bass sound, isn't it? Saw at that time was certainly keeping an ear to the ground with what was happening in R&B and pop and all the new sounds that were coming out across the US and the UK.
Speaking of Saw, let's hear from Mike Stock about the decision to give an old OG Brown song to Rick for the follow-up to Never Gonna Give You Up. Here is Mike.
It's all to do with suddenly you've got a massive worldwide buzz about Rick Astley and you need an album quick. I think Pete Walsman probably thought, here's one we could stick on the album to begin with. And, you know, we did it with Kylie and Got To Be Certain. But what I can say is once Never Gonna Give You Up, which took, I think Matt and me probably spent 6 months off and on humming and ahhing about that and getting it right. And once you've got beyond the first hurdle of who this guy is, what's his voice like, who is he a singer, other songs that you've done fit into that or they don't. So you pick the ones that say that matches up with our sort of, as it were, pattern or template, what Rick Astley is. And whenever you need somebody, yeah, I think it's a good record and a good song. Yeah, and I think it did work for him. I wrote others specifically. It Would Take a Strong Man, for example, which came out of the R&B Motown sort of pocket. It to showcase his voice. But yes, generally, if we were starting with a new artist from scratch who we didn't know what they were, we would write a song for that purpose. But, you know, after that event, the world takes over and you've got to go with the flow.
So it really does feel like the success of Never Gonna Give You Up took everyone by surprise. And it was almost like a bit of a scramble of, oh, quick, we need a follow up. What have we got? What can we do? And hey, presto, Whenever You Need Somebody was handed to Rick.
Yeah, look, I don't think anyone could have predicted just how huge that record was going to be. It certainly came out of nowhere as far as Saw were concerned. You know, they even had their doubts about that single before it was released. But, you know, the success was so huge and, you know, we're going to see something similar happen again after Kylie's I Should Be So Lucky. They really had to pull out all stops to make sure that the next single was going to match that kind of success. And they did a good job.
Yeah, it was definitely a more commercial offering than Ochi's version. It still sounds similar because it's the same song, but Rick's version is definitely aimed more at radio than the clubs. Let's hear from Pete Hammond, who mixed Rick's version of Whenever You Need Somebody, to see what he had to say about the track.
To be honest, I never had anything to do with Ochi Brown, and I don't think I even heard that version before I did the Rick version. I didn't change it around much from what they'd done because it was pretty good anyway, just made it sound good as we usually do. That was my job. But I wasn't told to make it different. I never heard the other version, so I wouldn't know, you see.
Well, there you go. Pete didn't even know it was a cover.
Yeah, well, we didn't either, so we can't really point the finger, can we?
No, exactly. Now, Rick's second single with Saw was another smash, as we've established, but next up is an artist whose second Saw single did not take off in the UK, much like her first. The smooth, sultry, seductive I Just Can't Wait hadn't turned Mandy Smith into a pop star in the UK, so for the follow-up, Saw took her in a dramatically different direction. Here is Positive Reaction by Mandy Smith. Bursting with energy, Positive Reaction felt more appropriate for Mandy, who at this stage was still only 17, and for me, this is a much stronger song than I Just Can't Wait, which I always found a little bit wishy-washy. This is impactful, right up there with the likes of I Heard a Rumor and Toy Boy as among my favourite Saw releases for 1987. Matt?
Yeah, I've got an interesting story about this one. I actually went out and bought it without ever having heard it. That speaks of two things. Firstly, at this point, I was so confident about the quality of Saw's releases, I didn't feel I even needed to hear them. And secondly, I was all aboard the Mandy train because I was very aware of what was being written about her in the press. Around this time, I was reading about, you know, the incident that Mike Stock referred to earlier when we spoke to him last about Mandy, where Mandy was booed off stage in London. And, you know, I love an underdog. So if people were going to hate on Mandy, I'm going to love her. So I was there for those two reasons. Took the record home, put it on my turntable and was not disappointed at all. I also really loved the fact that she'd changed her image. You know, I think by this stage she probably had a professional stylist working with her. She looked very different from her first single, where, you know, I wasn't really that much of a fan of what she was doing with her hair and clothes, but she looked good here. Unfortunately, it didn't translate into major chart success in the UK or Australia, where it didn't chart, did it, Gavin?
No, it did not, but it did okay in Europe, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It got to number 16 in Italy, where literally every single Mandy ever released went top 20. They loved her over there. Got to number 11 in Switzerland as well. 39 in Germany, a bit of a drop after number 14 placing for her first single. But again, looks like the Europeans gave Mandy more of a chance than she got in the English-speaking world. And I guess that's probably because the media was so hostile towards her following the Bill Wyman scandal.
One big difference for me is that fitting the style of the song, the vocal also felt more dynamic than I Just Can't Wait. I really love all those, whoa. Actually, shall we let Mandy do it? You don't want to hear me singing. This is the bit I really like. But all was not what it seemed when it came to Mandy Smith's vocals. We heard in the I Just Can't Wait episode that the producers had to work that little bit harder to get a good take out of Mandy. But what we didn't discuss is that it's a little bit of an open secret that Mandy's voice received a boost from session singer Suzanne Radigan. Now, this comes down to the difference between ordinary backing vocals, a guide vocal, and a ghost vocal. A guide vocal is when a session singer sings the lead vocal on a demo so that when the actual performer comes in, they have something to sing along to. Usually that guide vocal is then taken out of the mix. But sometimes a session singer's work on the lead vocal will stay on the track with varying degrees of prominence. And when it's really prominent, that's known as ghosting. Matt, are you familiar with the idea of ghost vocals?
Yeah, I am. There are all sorts of rumors in the music industry about who was ghosted and how much they were ghosted. Take it to its most sort of extreme and fraudulent extent. You have people like Milli Vanilli. Now, we're not talking about that here with Mandy, but you know, ghosting is always going to be controversial, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Now, this is definitely a case where Mandy was on the record. So let's hear from Suzanne about how she came to work at PWL and what her involvement on Mandy Smith's records was.
I answered an ad for producer looking for singers, and it turned out to be Daze Washburn, who worked for Pete. So when Mike and Matt and Pete had headed off to the pub, Daze and Roddy and whomever else, and Phil and Ian often at night would mix through the night in the other studio or whatever. And so I auditioned, I think it was about 12 o'clock one night for some project. I was 24 at the time, or even younger, I can't remember. And Pete came in and stuck his head around the door and said, oh no, you're too old. So, but they like my voice, so that's how they started getting me back to do sessions after that.
Was it kind of job by job, or were you kind of just there, part of the furniture?
Well, a little bit. I had to work it a bit at the beginning, so Days and maybe Phil and a couple of, I don't want to say second string, just the other producing teams in there at that time were using me a bit more often, and Mike and Matt were very happy with their singers, May and D and gosh, her name's popped out of my head now. Oh my
God. Miriam?
Miriam. Yeah, and they were fabulous. They May and Miriam did a lot of work together. But then Mike, I think, called me in to do something where he needed a young sounding voice and something that would blend into whatever it was. I'm trying to remember what the very first thing was I did in there, and I can't. But they quickly realized that I was useful for a certain type of projects, and that was tended to be the younger side of things. So they had in their minds that May and Miriam were for the more mature sounding records, and with the sort of more group backing vocals, they would often work together. And whereas I was called in for projects that needed maybe a bit of double tracking with vocals, where I could really blend my single voice with another single voice, you know, to sort of do that type of thing, you know, the really pop end of it. So, and that became someone they used to call on for that. And like, I used to lobby heavily to do other records that I was interested in, more interested in doing, not from any credibility point of view, but I do remember, as an aside, when they started working with Donna Summer, I was desperate to get onto that, and they just weren't having it. They were, you know, no, we're using the you know, the big girls for that, you know. So I wasn't included in that. I was very disappointed with that. So, you know, you had to still lobby. I would still, you know, if I hadn't heard from them for a few weeks, I'd turn up and kind of go, what are you working on? And see if I could get remembered, you know, to come in and do something. But no, it was consistent work for about 4 or 5 years, I suppose, at that point.
In terms of the working environment, was it a fun place to be around or was it hard?
It was fun. No, it wasn't hard. For me, again, I think maybe more maybe than some of the other singers, I would often have been there at the songwriting part because they would merge quite a lot with, they'd still be writing songs and the artist might be waiting to go in and sing a lead vocal and I would be in the studio with them singing the lead vocals for demo purposes, if you like, maybe for an artist who might be only going to be there for an hour to learn the song and that kind of thing. And so then there might have been the odd occasion where the lyrics weren't written and it would be like, oh, just sing whatever comes into your head at that point, Suzanne, you know, kind of thing. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, my lyrics were ever made it to a final cut or anything, but, you know, you'd be sort of like, oh, right, so sing a line and then make something up. You know, but it was really just to fill the gaps so they could kind of quickly write a song. I mean, they might have been working on 4 or 5 or more records at one time, you know. It was pretty intense, but not difficult work. It wasn't like hugely challenging. I mean, I suppose the only other singer I would have worked with, I sometimes worked with May and Miriam, but was Mike himself. We had quite a nice blend together. So we used to do a lot of vocals together. And when it did get a bit more challenging, if you weren't quite getting something, it was more banter than anything else. You'd be told up front, you know, you weren't cutting. There was no plaw mossing and soft soaping or anything. But, you know, as long as you could give as good as you got, you were all right. You know, like I didn't have any problem giving back what I got anyway, put it that way. So and it was fun. It was great fun. And it was such an exciting time. I mean, God, there was champagne bottles opening every other day because they'd be having another number one somewhere, you know, so, and there was a terrific amount of energy in the place and young staff and up and coming people. And so it was a really good, positive place to work.
In terms of the banter, was that with Mike? Because Mike obviously is a singer himself and used to work with the singers quite closely.
All three. Like I got on very well with all of them. Pete wouldn't be in the studio that much. He would wander in and say, oh, that's a great record, check that out, I like that bass line and whatever. And or he'd say, how about I'm off to the park, that's a title for a song, and he'd walk back out again. Do you know what I mean? Because he was busy with other stuff as well, but he was the boss. Like, you know, you kind of knew when he was arriving that, you know, his word was going to be the final word. Matt is hilarious. He's very funny, very witty guy. And so he would always be throwing in very dry, acerbic comments. But Mike did all the producing of the vocals pretty much. You know, he would have been the one who would be telling you what to do and what not to do.
Mandy was one of the artists who your voice was blended with her voice. Am I right in thinking that?
Well, I think it would probably, and she'd be probably the first to tell you, was slightly more than that. It was pretty much me. And Mandy kind of sang along a bit, but that was more what they would describe as a ghost vocal job. And, you know, I was paid a royalty for that record. That was the only time that I came close to falling out with Pete really properly, because they got me in, they told me what the situation was, they asked me if I was prepared to do it, and we came to an agreement, and I did. I think it might have been Just Can't Wait to See You. So it went really well. And I think they were having a bit of success with it in Japan and in other territories and stuff. And I happened to mention to my mother, nobody else, because I mean, Pete, I don't think he expressly said it, but he may have said it, like, just don't be blabbing around that you're the voice of Mandy Smith, which, you know, this is not an unusual thing in the professional music business for people to session musicians and singers to ghost vocal. You know, there's many artists, you know, going back to Gene Kelly and Singing in the Rain, it's not an unusual process. So I had no intention of telling anyone. I was quite happy to keep things to myself, but I mentioned it to my mother, and she had a friend who was a journalist here in Ireland, and she happened to mention it to her. And the next thing, it's in the Sunday newspaper here in Ireland. And obviously whoever was managing Mandy picked up on it, and I got hauled in. Pete wants to see you, come to the office now. I had no idea what it was. And I went in and he told me that I wasn't ever going to work there again and blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, look, Pete, I said, I didn't speak to anyone, tracked it down, discovered it had been my mother who'd said something. I said, I'm sorry about it, but I certainly didn't go to the papers with it or anything like that. He was very annoyed about it and he didn't call me. And I'd say it was the longest period that I didn't get a call from them to do anything. And then the record really did go well and they came to do a follow-up single or whatever. They tried a few of the singers, but it wasn't Mandy anymore. So they had to kind of get me back. So that's how that went. And I said, look, don't worry about it. I won't be. It was fine. We sorted it out. But yeah, so he did try to replace me on it because he was so annoyed that he perceived that I had blabbed to the press, which I didn't.
The story I had was that her vocals weren't great on Terry and Gotta Be Certain and things like that. And it's kind of like, but if they had you there, were they still trying to make it work with her, do you think?
Maybe that was at the point where they started to realise that either they had to have me or that they needed someone. I can't remember the process, the sequence of the timeline of it. They may have tried with her before on Terry. I do remember singing Terry. I don't really remember singing Just Count One. Well, yeah, I'm sure I did, but I don't remember it. But I do remember Terry, and that might have been, I'm sure they probably tried her on her own. They certainly probably did, and maybe tried her with other singers too before they tried me. But like I say, it was kind of like, well, anyway, it ended up the way it did. I don't remember her singing on her own at any point, but it could have been. I don't know, to be fair. I don't know. An absolutely gorgeous person, I have to say. Lovely, lovely girl. Just a lovely person now, you know, in a completely different place in her life, thankfully for her. I mean, she was only a child, you know, she was a child and it wasn't, yeah. But she was very sweet, very lovely, absolutely spellbindingly beautiful. So it was no hardship working on it, really.
Was she aware what was happening with the vocal side of things?
Oh, absolutely. Because I can't remember, was it her launch or some other artist's launch in Stringfellows or some awful place in London and going to it and her coming across the dance floor and grabbing me and hauling me into some room with loads of people and going, this is the voice of Mandy Smith. You know, she knew. All along, she was under no illusions about it, you know. You know, she was a model, or at least that was really what I suppose she was heading toward at that point. And in some ways, the singing was just an extension of the modelling, you know, like you'd put makeup on a model, you might put a voice behind a singer, you know, it wasn't, you know, I don't think she had any artistic pretensions in that way.
Positive reaction was the follow up to I Just Can't Wait. I Just Can't Wait was a little bit more laid back of a song, whereas Positive Reaction is very energetic. Do you remember anything about recording Positive Reaction and the vocal delivery on that? Because the I Just Can't Wait delivery was quite soft, whereas Positive Reaction, you've got all those whoa bits in there.
I do remember enjoying that song, singing it. So maybe that's why it had a bit more life in it. Maybe at that point too, it was established what I was doing and I felt freer in the sense to kind of push it a little bit more maybe. Maybe it was Mike wanted more.
It's a bit more of a belter, that song. I guess you got to let loose a bit more.
A little bit, yeah. But always with the mind to keeping things very clean and not, it wasn't rock, like, or, you know, there was no, the vocal is still pure sounding. It wasn't soulful in the sense of, like, it didn't have soulful affectations to it. It was much more about, yeah, more the energy level might have been a bit more, yeah, suited to that particular song. It was a really good song, that, actually, yeah.
Mandy also worked with the other production teams, the B teams, for songs on her album. Did you go and do those vocals as well? It wasn't just with Saw.
It was the same, yeah.
So wherever Mandy went, you went.
Yeah. Well, yeah, one of the arrangements or agreements I came to with Pete on doing the record was that I got an opportunity to co-write something on it. So I did co-write a song. Now, it was a B-side, and I think it really was just a little house song, and it was just a repetitive line, but I got a songwriting credit. I wrote the lyric on it or whatever. Say It's Love, Love House, it's called. That was exciting for me because it was my first song that ever got put on a record properly, do you know what I mean? And that I had my name attached to. So, and that was with Phil and Ian.
I've had the Mandy album since. Then, no idea that is how it was put together, and so it's fascinating.
No. And just because it was put together that way doesn't mean it isn't a good record, I think.
No, not at all.
I've only listened back to it recently and I was surprised at how I liked the sound of the production on it. And yeah, I think it's got merit. honestly, you'd be amazed if the truth was ever allowed to come out about the extent to which ghost vocaling goes on in the industry. If, as long as you're not pretending to be Barbara Streisand or, you know, or Lady Gaga, that's where it would be a bit ridiculous to have a ghost vocal artist. But if you're a pop star or you're just a very pretty girl and you can sing a bit, but you're not great, what's the big deal? That would be my feeling on it. If the record sounds great and you want to dance to it and sing along with it, then why not?
I guess it depends on the ego involved. And it sounds like Mandy didn't have ego about it. She was just kind of like, it is what it is.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, maybe she's changed her point of view now, but I doubt it. I mean, she was always, like I say, when I was reassured when she came running over to me in Stringfellas that night and introduced me as the voice of Mandy Smith to all and sundry, and God knows who was there at the time. I have no idea. Could have been any journalist or whatever, you know, but she seemed to be accepting of it, so it was grand. And they sounded great, yeah. And I hope she enjoyed herself.
Okay, wow, how great was that? So many revelations. After I first heard that interview with Suzanne, I went back to Mandy's album and listened to the whole thing. And my goodness, it's certainly a different experience when you sit there and sort of analyze and dissect and sort of try to work out exactly what's happening. Still love the records, though. Still love Mandy as a pop star as well. And how great is it that she apparently had a bit of a sense of humor about the whole situation behind the scenes? And I also loved that story about Pete Waterman blowing his stack, apparently, over, you know, what was printed in one of the Irish newspapers. And then the fact that Suzanne was brought back in regardless, despite that confrontation, despite that unpleasant moment. So many fascinating details, Gavin.
Yeah, it was great to speak to Suzanne. And, you know, people have been telling me for a while, oh, so you're going to speak to Suzanne? You know, a couple of listeners who were aware of the situation there were like, oh, you have to speak to Suzanne. So I was really glad that Suzanne was able to chat to us, and she was fantastic. We're going to hear from her in future episodes as well. She has some interesting things to say about some other records we're going to get to. But back to Mandy, and although Saw did work with her on a few more tracks for her debut album, her subsequent singles were produced by other members of the PWL team. Let's have a listen to Boys and Girls, Victim of Pleasure, Don't You Want Me Baby. Here we go.
Great was that run of singles. I loved every single one of those. And you know, when each one of them was released, it really felt for me like Mandy was on the verge of breaking through finally. I even remember when Boys and Girls came out, there was a lot of press here in Australia, you know, along the lines of finally a hit for Mandy Smith. Unfortunately, it didn't happen here in Australia, but those tracks got quite a bit of exposure. She does have quite a following here among PWL fans. And I'm going to say it, I actually think I like Boys and Girls and Victim of Pleasure even better than her two Saw singles. They're really high quality stuff. It is a great shame she never became a mainstream pop star in the English speaking world, but at least Europe loved those singles, where a lot of those tracks were top 40 hits.
Now, in the bonus material for this episode, we are going to go through Mandy's debut album, Mandy, and we'll talk in more detail about those singles and the rest of the tracks on the album. Don't You Want Me Baby wasn't included on that album, but hey, we'll talk about that as well, because it's kind of tacked on as a bonus track these days for reissues and things like that. Now, from one underrated Saw track, we come to another. Matt, who's up next?
Yeah, next we've got a bit of a fan favourite, a song that was never an official singles chart hit, but it did go on an album that went on to sell a reported 6 million copies around the world. Let's have a listen to Turn It Up by Michael Davidson.
Your voice is turning on my love.
That was Turn It Up by Michael Davidson, released in late 1987. It didn't chart, but if you were an 80s pop kid, you definitely knew this track. That's because it was on the soundtrack for the Madonna movie Who's That Girl. That was right at the very height of 80s Madonna mania, so there really was no bigger honour for a prospective pop star than to be chosen to go on that LP, which, as I said, sold millions. What did you think of Turn It Up, Gavin?
I really like Turn It Up. It's not my favourite non-Madonna song on the Who's That Girl soundtrack. That would be the Skritti Politti track that is on there. But I do really love Turn It Up by Michael Davidson. It's got a lot of energy. It's very much in the vein of songs like Positive Reaction or Get Ready by Carol Hitchcock from around 1987. Kind of high energy, kind of Europop. Yeah, I think it's really fantastic, upbeat. And I'm surprised it didn't chart at all, especially with Saw by this stage really successful and having, as you said, the backing of the Who's That Girl soundtrack. I'm surprised it didn't at least crack the top 100 in the UK. Anyway, what about you? What do you think of this one?
Yeah, it's a really good track. I think probably I'm going to speculate it got lost because he was an American record company project. If it didn't work in America, it probably wasn't going to get pushed in by the UK branch, that sort of thing. Nobody really understood Saw in America at this point. They were having hits occasionally, but they weren't the powerhouse that they were in the UK. So if you just release something produced by Saw, that wasn't going to be a massive selling point to radio at that point. In the UK, he wasn't really well known. And perhaps you could also say this might have sounded a bit earlier, 87. I don't know exactly when it was recorded, but with House blowing up around this point, the sort of more conventional high energy type pop might have perhaps felt a little bit old at this point. This was, you know, one of those turning points in pop music around this time, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a very good point you make. One thing we should talk about at this stage, in the spirit of the energy of this track, is the music video and Michael's dancing. If you haven't seen the video, check it out on YouTube and watch him go.
Yeah, he's certainly got some moves, doesn't he? And he does them again and again and again in the video, doesn't he? I don't think there was much of a plot line for this video. It just really features Michael, which perhaps he was being guided by Madonna at this point where, you know, she was smart enough to center herself and to be the center of attention in her videos, not get lost in any sort of convoluted storyline. And, you know, that would make sense because he was so signed to Madonna's label.
Now, that's an interesting story, isn't it? How Michael Davidson ended up being signed to Sire. It's, he spoke about it about a decade ago in an interview with San Francisco Gate, where he basically told the story of how he ended up at Sire. It's a good story, isn't it, Matt?
Yeah, it's funny. He was in Europe, apparently backpacking or on a holiday. He'd been asleep on the beach in Saint-Tropez, and he caught the attention of a couple of women there who were apparently in the European music industry. They thought he might be good to appear on one of their records. Then he sort of got involved in the music world over there. And then Andy Warhol came over to visit France, and apparently Michael was very well connected because they had friends in common. He met up with Andy Warhol. He became a part of Andy's troupe while Andy was in France. Then Andy became a huge fan, decided he wanted to sort of help Michael become a pop star, told him that he should call himself Joe America. Michael wasn't really keen on that, but you know, Andy's connections did help because apparently Andy hooked him up with Seymour Stein at Sire Records, and Michael had a bunch of songs written, including Turn It Up, which apparently that was what got him the deal. So a bit of writing talent certainly helps to get you across the line, and off he went off to Saw to record this song.
Yeah, that's right. It's a story of right place at the right time and meeting the right people, and you know, Michael's very good looks wouldn't have hurt one little bit. But we did track him down. I exchanged some messages with Michael online to try and A, get him on the show, and B, get to the bottom of the Turn It Up story and get all the details we want to know. Unfortunately, Michael declined my offer for an interview. He said to me that he hated doing interviews at the time. He didn't think he was any good at them, and that he thought music should speak for itself. And I thought, well, there goes our whole podcast. If music is supposed to speak for itself, what are we doing? But he did answer a couple of questions for me. He told me, and I'm quoting, I guess, Turn It Up was the only track I did with Saw. Turn It Up was already earmarked for the Who's That Girl soundtrack when I recorded it with Saw, but there was a demo already, so it was not written for the soundtrack. The demo is one of the tracks that I used to get my record deal. So Turn It Up was in existence. someone thought, hey, this could be a good song to put on Who's That Girl? And as we've mentioned, he was in Madonna's orbit. He'd been chatting to Stephen Bray when she got to Sire. So he was definitely on the radar there. And obviously they thought, you know, this needs really good production. Let's ship him over to London, get him to work with Saw, and they worked their magic on the track. And there we go. That's how the song came together. But yes, Michael did co-write the track. Now, at the time, he was working on an album. Album never saw the light of day, but one other track that he recorded called Midnight Cargo has found its way online. Let's have a little bit of a listen to that. So that was Midnight Cargo, which was written about in a Rolling Stone story done on Michael in 1987, and that was billed as coming from his upcoming album, the upcoming album that never came up. And then it wasn't until 2 years later that he released another single called Warehouse, which had a very different style from Turn It Up. Let's have a listen to Warehouse. So, Matt, a really strong acid house vibe on that track, wasn't there?
Yeah, very, very acid, very 89. Kind of a strange choice, but a brave choice for an American artist, because that sound never had any kind of major impact on the US charts. Of course, massive, massive, massive in the UK and quite well known here in Australia, but it didn't really work. And I've got to say, that's not a particularly super strong song and the production isn't particularly amazing. So it wasn't the big uplift that he needed, unfortunately. And as you said, his album got shelved. He told our San Francisco Gate, quote, "I recorded the album with producers in London, New York, and LA. But sadly, the album never came out as Warner Brothers was cutting its roster and I slipped through the cracks." Sad story. You know, so much promise with that first single, but it wasn't to be, was it? And we know that Michael did go on to other creative pursuits. He ended up doing a fine art photography business, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. I don't mind Warehouse. Again, he has some pretty good moves in the video. The video is very much centered on him, just kind of grooving away to this song. It's a bit more understated. It's not so much arms flailing all over the place like in Turn It Up, just a bit more grooving. But yeah, his music career wasn't to be, and he transitioned into the world of art, which, as far as I know, he's still working in. So, you know, it was nice to at least connect with Michael Davidson and find out that, yes, he's still out there and following artistic pursuits. But unfortunately, we weren't able to get him on the show to hear his full story. And so that brings us to the end of this episode. Another batch of interesting singles there. In the bonus material for this episode, Matt and I will work our way through the Mandy Smith album. And also, we're going to hear more from Suzanne Rattigan, more of our interview with her. You can find the bonus material at chartbeats.com.au/Saw, where you can subscribe for as little as $2 a month to hear the bonus material from all the episodes. And also, you can hear the bonus material from my other podcast, A Journey Through Aussie Pop. Matt, in our next episode, we are going to reach the end of 1987, aren't we?
I can't believe it. It's gone so fast. Such a great year in Saw's history, but 88 just around the corner with some fantastically successful and iconic acts and records.
Well, in fact, we're going to dip our toe into 1988. Next episode, we're going to cover the very first Saw single released in 1988.
And it's probably my favourite ever single with Saw by the act concerned. It's certainly one of my favourite Saw records of all time. It's awesome.
Well, Matt, I'm captivated by your honey.
Well, who isn't, Gavin? Let's be honest.
If you want to be captivated by Matt's honey on social media, where can they find you, Matt?
You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Matt Denby. I love to hear from you, so please do get in touch. And if you want to follow Chartbeats, you can find Chartbeats AU on Instagram and Twitter. You can find Chartbeats by searching on Facebook.
And it's great to hear from you, whether you are in Toronto or Torquay or Marrickville or Manila. We've got listeners all around the world, and it's great to hear from you all. So that's it for this episode. See you in another fortnight. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye, everybody.